I'll start by saying that this past Friday was the Celtic holiday of Lugnasa, which is a midsummer festival in many ways. And Lugnasa is, it's often seen as a high point of male energy in the year. A male pole, you might say. 6 months ago, around the female pole of the year, Imbolc, I gave a talk on the sacred feminine, so it seemed appropriate to talk about the masculine now. And I guess the first thing I want to preface it to preface is that I'm going to be talking about the archetypal masculine and archetypal feminine. And these are patterns that stretch back thousands of years. They really stretch back into prehistory. They're not, how can I say, if I'm saying that something like leadership pertains to the archetypal masculine, I'm not making the absurd statement that only men can be leaders, you know. I mean, anyone can be a good leader, men, woman, anyone on the LGBT spectrum. But I would say that anyone who is a good leader is probably drawing on their inner masculine in some way. I would say that the masculine and feminine, the archetypal masculine and the archetypal feminine, are two deep wells in each of us. And there's tremendous strength and wisdom and power to be drawn from both of these wells. And, you know, how we choose to identify and, you know, what, you know, the surface presentation we make to the world is one thing, but we all have this opportunity to draw from both of these wells. And so I'll also say that, you know, it's funny, there's the archetypal masculine and the archetypal feminine. And to some extent, these are represented in what we think of as more traditional cultural roles of the masculine and the feminine. But it's funny, the cultural roles, to some extent, they represent the archetypes, and to some extent, they're travesties of them, you know. In much in the same way that if we looked at the behavior of members of any religion, you know, the real life behavior of those people would, in some sense, represent some of the ideals of the religion, but in other ways would be travesties of those ideals, you know. It just kind of a recognition of our all too human way of being. But certainly, over the past several millennia, there's been a privileging of the masculine over the feminine, in the system that is called patriarchy. And patriarchy, of course, has harmed women, but it has really harmed men also. And I think that's something that is less appreciated. And it's funny, even in feminism, there are many streams of feminism, but some versions of feminism I would call more assimilationist, giving the message essentially, women, you need to develop these male qualities to be successful in the male world. And there's nothing wrong with that, but in a way that's also playing into the privileging of the masculine over the feminine, you know. Now, of course, there are other versions of feminism that valorize the deep feminine. So, you know, feminism is a very diverse field in and of itself. And I'll also say a curious thing about this time that we're living in, this, you know, you might call it a post-patriarchal time that we're in, is that there are men walking around now who actually feel compelled to apologize for the fact that they're men or embarrassed that they're men, you know? And the first thing I'll say is that really no human being should feel that they have to apologize for who they are. And I think I'd also say that men apologizing for being men, I would put this in the same category as like white guilt and white people apologizing for racism, that sort of thing. You know, in other words, it's a codependent behavior. It doesn't really serve anyone. I think it's just important to name. So in our current world, I would say that there are some healthy forms of masculinity. There are many unhealthy forms of masculinity. And I think as a way to frame this, I'll point to the fact that so far as we understand, through all prehistory, stretching back tens of thousands of years, in all cultures, when young men hit puberty, they would go through initiation rituals. And in many cultures, these were harrowing rituals. You know, the young men might have teeth knocked out, they might, you know, as adolescent men be circumcised or have subincision, you know. And it was designed to be a terrifying, harrowing experience. And the young men would emerge from that as men of the tribe. Now, you know, in various ways over the past couple thousand years, it's been less formal that there's been these initiation rituals. You know, certainly to some extent, the military has played that role, you know, to some extent, boot camp, that sort of thing. But really, we live in a world now where it's entirely haphazard, you know, what kind of formation a young man has. And I think the way I would say it is that the initiation rituals were recognition that there is a kind of wildness that is part of what it is to be a man. And this wildness really emerges in the teenage years. And the question is, you know, what relationship is the man going to have to his wildness? And so I think right now, there are some versions of unhealthy masculinity in which that wildness has not been tamed at all, and the men are wild as adults in the world. And then there's other versions of masculinity that you might say are over-tamed, where men have been disconnected entirely from their wildness, you know. So one kind of unhealthy masculinity is something that is often called toxic masculinity. And I think one way to say it, I think I'll back up and say that almost all the unhealthy forms of masculinity, what they have in common in one way or another is fear of the feminine and avoidance of the feminine. And this, you know, we can go back to you know, the Chinese had this nailed 3,000 years ago that yin and yang are balanced when they're in sync with each other. But if you get yang by itself without yin, or yin by itself without yang, you get something very imbalanced. So toxic masculinity, those are the men who are, you know, there's no vulnerability, there's no introspection. It's all about machismo and aggression and, you know, often played out in violence and fighting and harsh competition and this sort of thing. And there's, a lot of untamed, wild male energy in the way that plays out. Some of that behavior leads to early death. Some of it leads to imprisonment, you know. Related to that, and maybe this is more, I don't know to what extent this might have to do with education level or socioeconomic class, but there are also some more untamed men who you might call the players, you know. They're very connected to their animal energies. They're very connected to their sexuality. They're not connected to empathy. They're not connected to heart qualities. And so they're very good at seducing women. They're the pickup artists, you know. They're with one woman after another, you know. But then when the conversation turns around to what about commitment, what about et cetera, then they're out the door. And of course, there are codependent women who think they can save these men, and of course they can't. On the other side, the over-tame men, There's a term in the men's movement, the nice guys. The guys who, they're connected to heart qualities. They want to do well. But there's a strong codependent pattern, and they're not very connected to their vulnerability, their sexuality, their passion. And so they present as, you know, often they present just as a disconnected head, you know, that sort of thing, you know, but with, you know, sort of generous heart feelings. And women love to be friends with these people, but often these men are not particularly successful with women, which leads to a lot of anger and resentment. Unfortunately, there is a movement called the incel movement, a very sick movement that preys on these men. The incel stands for involuntarily celibate. And then, you know, there's this whole philosophy there, this angry screwed up philosophy of how the problem is feminism and women shouldn't be empowering themselves and all this. So it's a sad thing. There's a tremendous need for healing for men in this culture. And unfortunately, some of the men who are in most need of healing have absolutely no idea that they need healing, you know. I would say that, you know, what is the healthy relationship to one's wildness? So if I'm being run by my wildness, then that's not healthy. If I'm disconnected from my wildness, that's not healthy. You might say that the healthy relationship is the man who can, as it were, have a partnership or friendship with his wildness. And this is really represented mythologically by the friendship between Gilgamesh and Enkidu in the myth of Gilgamesh, the hero and the wild man, and the deep friendship that they had. And of course, that myth served as a template in many ways for the Han Solo Chewbacca friendship in the Star Wars movies. So for a man who's more connected to his wildness, but connected to heart qualities, connected to ethics, what is the emotionally intelligent way that wildness might come out? Well, this wild male energy, among other things, comes out in play. I don't know that I would say that all play is masculine, but there certainly is a masculine quality of play. And some of it is teasing and pushing the envelope. Some of that plays out in flirting. Some of it is the kind of sort of headbutting, kind of teasing that men do amongst each other, you know, which can be seen very rough and very harsh if you are not privy to the emotional bonds between the men. And so playfulness is definitely one important quality of the masculine. In general, I would say that the archetypal masculine, the masculine qualities or the virtues of the archetypal masculine are virtues about moving out into the world, creating, exploring. Whereas virtues of the archetypal feminine are about our ability to receive, our ability to surrender and allow. You know, it's a paradox in some ways that many of the virtues of the archetypal masculine are things we have to strive for. We have to put intention or effort into them. Whereas many of the virtues of the archetypal feminine are about what we can relax into, what we can, by surrendering, what we can allow to happen. So one interesting way to talk about the difference between masculine and feminine is the very traditional marriage vow. And, you know, say 100 years ago, men would swear, I will love, honor, and serve. And women would swear, I would love, honor, and obey. Those are the extremely traditional vows. I had a professor in grad school who was, he was an older gentleman, and he had been married for many years, and he one day told us that he and his wife had fun kind of, you know, this sort of back and forth argument over the course of their marriage, who got the better deal, you know, the one who was serving or the one who was obeying, you know, that sort of thing. And obey is really, it's a horrible word because in our time it brings up slavery and oppression and destructive power dynamics and all that. Serve is really a powerful word for the archetypal masculine, the way that the archetypal masculine engages in the world. You might say that allow and receive are ways that the archetypal feminine engages with the world. And I would say in any healthy relationship, both people are serving and both people are allowing and receiving. You know, there is this back and forth between them. Leadership is a quality of the archetypal masculine. And I think really the deep insight of the archetypal masculine is that to lead is to serve. You know, that leadership, you know, the travesty of leadership when it becomes about self-aggrandizing. It ultimately is something driven by toxic shame. You know, I need to put myself above others and feel good that I'm above others, as opposed to seeing it as a vessel of service. Another quality of the archetypal masculine, you might say, is a rootedness or a stability. And this gets played out in a very shallow way by the toxic males who might have a lot of machismo and, you know, put on this invulnerable front of, you know, well, nothing affects me and, you know, I don't cry and, you know, nothing, you know, I'm not moved by anything kind of thing. And you know, what's sad about that is that it's like this outside hard shell, but then inside there's a tremendous amount of pain and they're not even aware that they're carrying that pain, you know. And a much more healthy way that this solidity can play out is in the man who is in touch with vulnerability, the man who can be open to others and hear others' opinions and receive criticism and feedback and all that. But beneath all that, is grounded in this deep layer of inner calm, inner stability. And when there's this powerful ground of inner calm and inner stability, honor can grow from that ground. And I think we've all seen a really powerful example of a man with this deep inner ground of stability from whom a tremendous amount of honor has grown. In former President Barack Obama. So the archetypal masculine is the solid, as opposed to the archetypal feminine, which is in flow. And I think more the patterns of patriarchy were about confining the flow, restricting the flow, preventing the flow, you know. Part of the archetypal masculine is to hold a container, to allow the flow, and in some ways also to focus the flow so that the flow is not just this trickle in all directions, but when flow is focused, it can be a fire hose, you know? And so that is a service that the archetypal masculine can do for the archetypal feminine, to focus it and give it power, you know? Courage is interesting because I would say there's a species of courage that is more aligned with the archetypal masculine, a species of courage that's more aligned with the archetypal feminine. The courage of the archetypal masculine is about going out, exploring, confronting the threat, confronting the stranger, you know, pushing out into new territory. The courage of the associated with the archetypal feminine is about sitting still. It's about dropping into what's here, being with everything that is here, you know, which in many ways is no less courageous than, you know, facing the biggest threat out there. And in fact, there's this tremendous yin-yang interplay between those two, obviously, because the more I can sit and face everything within myself without fear, then the more I can face things out in the world without fear, you know. So there's those two really nourish each other very much. I would say ultimately when we talk about the sacred masculine, the sacred masculine is often associated with the sky, you know, Yahweh, the god of Judaism and Christianity, is a sky god, clearly, you know, as was Zeus, as was Indra. It's about the sacred as transcendent, the sacred as you know, vast beyond, highest above, you know, this sort of thing. Whereas the archetypal feminine is often associated with the earth, and it's often associated with the inward. So it is the sacred as immanent, as opposed to the sacred as transcendent. And of course, 3,000 years ago in the Upanishad, we already have these statements that, you know, they use for the transcendent sacred, they use the term Brahman, cosmic consciousness. For the sacred, the immanent sacred, they use the term Atman, innermost self. And one of the primary statements of the Upanishads is that Atman is Brahman, that those two are one and the same. And so that when you go deepest within, you are, as it were, contacting the highest above and furthest beyond. You know, which makes sense, because ultimately the closer we get to the sacred, the more we're moving past all of these dualities, you know. So at this point, I'm going to share the quote sheet. I'll put it in the chat. And so at the top of the quote sheet, I have a Zen story. The master, Kasan, was asked to officiate at the funeral of a provincial lord. He had never met lords and nobles before, so he was nervous. When the ceremony started, he sweat. Afterwards, when he had returned, he gathered his pupils together. Kasan confessed that he was not yet qualified to be a teacher, for he lacked the sameness of bearing in the world of fame that he possessed in a secluded temple. Then Kasan resigned and became the pupil of another master. 8 years later, he returned to his former pupils, enlightened. So this whole idea of this deep stability that is part of the archetypal masculine. I love this quote from the philosopher Emperor Marcus Aurelius. Waste no more time arguing about what a good man should be. Be one. And it's true that you know, here I am giving a talk about the archetypal masculine, and really to be a man is much more about how you live. It's about action. It's not about words. A passage from Walt Whitman, and of course it's always interesting to have their perspective on men from somebody who is attracted to men. And Walt Whitman said, "The male too is not less the soul nor more. He is too in his place. He too is all qualities. He is action and power. The flush of the known universe is in him. Scorn becomes him well, and appetite and defiance become him well. The wildest passions, bliss that is utmost, sorrow that is utmost, become him well. Pride is for him. The full spread pride of man is calming and excellent to the soul. Knowledge becomes him. He likes it always. He brings everything to the test of himself. Whatever the survey, whatever the sea and the sail, he strikes soundings at last only here. Where else does he strike soundings except here?" So quite a few ideas in that passage from Whitman. Orison Swett Marden said, "This is the test of your manhood. How much is there left in you after you've lost everything outside of you?" And again, this whole idea that, you know, a true man would have this deep rootedness that would not be dependent on the fluctuations around them. Gandhi said, "Maleness consists not in bluff, bravado, or loneliness. It consists in the daring to do the right thing and facing the consequences, whether it is in matters social, political, or other. It consists in deeds and not in words." And I think that that is equally true in the political forum as well as in the most intimate settings, you know. Carl Jung said, "I've noticed that people usually have not much difficulty in picturing them to themselves what the shadow, even if they, what is meant by the shadow, even if they would have preferred a bit of Latin or Greek jargon that sounds more scientific. But of course, it costs them enormous difficulty to understand what the anima is. They accept her easily enough when she appears in novels or as a film star, but she is not understood when it comes to seeing the role she plays in their own lives, because she sums up everything a man can never get the better of and never finishes coping with. Therefore, it remains in a perpetual state of emotionality which must not be touched. The degree of unconsciousness one meets with in this connection is, to put it mildly, astounding. Hence, it is practically impossible to get a man who is afraid of his own femininity to understand what is meant by the anima." And it's interesting, Jung's whole idea of the anima, it's a very deep and complex idea, but when he was writing, it was really a world in which, you know, it was a much more traditional world, a world in which, as it were men and women were women. And the whole idea that a man might be in touch with his feminine, that was a very foreign idea in that world. That's an idea much more comfortable now. And so I think that the anima for modern men is not as deeply othered as it was for men in Jung's time, which is not to say that it is an easy idea to approach, but it is sort of the magic that surrounds the inner feminine. Emiliano Zapata, who was an extraordinary man, a man of tremendous heart, tremendous integrity, said, "It's better to die on your feet than to live on your knees." This incredibly powerful statement. Einstein said, "Try not to be a man of success, rather become a man of value." The whole idea of what is your manhood based on, something external or internal. Herb Goldberg said, "The male has paid a heavy price for his masculine privilege and power. He is out of touch with his emotions and his body. He is playing by the rules of the male game plan, and with lemming-like purpose, he is destroying himself emotionally, psychologically, and physically." The radical theologian Matthew Fox said, "When the sacred masculine is combined with the sacred feminine inside each of us, we create the sacred marriage of compassion and passion in ourselves." Robert Moore, in his wonderful book, said, "Submission to the power of the mature masculine energies always brings forth a new masculine personality that is marked by calm, compassion, clarity of vision, and generativity." The powerful healer, Mallarmé Somme, says, "The truth is our disconnection with the earth translates into a kind of disrespect for the feminine. How far can you go in violating the mother that gave you life? As long as the feminine is diminished, the connection between us and the earth will always be underscored by a big question mark. We have abused the earth so much that we don't know which direction to go. We must wonder about this increasing masculinity that is translated in terms of repeated violence or love of it." Anatole Gambato-Burke says, "Our culture is now one of masculine triumphalism, in which trans-historically feminine expression, empathy, sweetness, volubility, warmth, are seen as impediments to a woman's professional trajectory in many sectors. And I'd like to think that that is changing, at least in some places, but that's certainly true. Libo Grand says, "I believe that a woman's sensuality makes the best of a man." And there is something powerful, at least in a heterosexual relationship, when the woman can go deep into her feminine and the man can go deep into his masculine, they really can, as it were, bring out the best of each other. And I think there are similar dynamics in you know, across the relationships on the LGBT spectrum, at least some of the time. Habib Akande said, "You become a man when you reach, not when you reach a certain age, but when you reach a certain state of mind." And finally, from Dr. Denise Rain, she says, "The redefining of the sacred male principles, the dawn of a new vibrant light, a mature masculinity that is not abusive, domineering, or grandiose, but generative, creative, and empowering. He is vulnerable without shame, revealing that his now discarded armor of invulnerability was nothing more than an illusion that hid his true power. He is now free and open to rediscover and reconnect with the power of nature and the cosmos. He is ready to reestablish a true relationship with authenticity and integrity. The great mystery moves through him, reminding him constantly that he is it and it is him. He is a force of nature first, a man second, a spear of Gaia herself, and no amount of perceived invulnerability can guard against it."